This is the Education Gadfly Show.
So the crowd should know that Kathleen and I combined have like 6 kids under the age of 5.
Exactly.
So we don't get out a whole lot to see movies.
We don't sleep enough to actually make it through a movie.
Now, here's your host.
Hello, I'm Andy Smerick of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute and Bellwether Education Partners, filling in for Mike Petrilli here today at the Education Gadfly Show and online at edexcellence.net. Please join me in welcoming my co-host, the Jennifer Lawrence of Education Policy, Kathleen Porter McGee.
I wish I was as slick as she is.
Isn't she something else?
Oh my God, it was awesome.
I mean, she falls and she handles it so well when she gets up and gets her award and acts like nothing happened. And then that post-conference, amazing.
My favorite was when they said, "Are you worried that you've peaked too soon?" And she said, "Well, now I am."
I know. I mean, those 90 seconds, I mean, that confidence and humor, man, she has it in spades. What movie was she in? It shows how much I know about this year's Academy. So how many of the 9 did you see of these best pictures?
I saw one, I think.
I saw Lincoln.
I did not see Lincoln. Mark saw Lincoln. I saw Argo.
Yeah, I didn't see that.
What else?
That's the Ben Affleck one?
Yeah.
So the crowd should know that Kathleen and I combined have like 6 kids under the age of 5.
Exactly.
So we don't get out a whole lot to see movies.
We don't sleep enough to actually make it through a movie.
That's right. So we're trying to be hip.
Okay,
So let's move on to something more important. Pardon the gadfly, the most exciting part of the show. Question 1.
English and U.S. history remain the most popular advanced placement courses, according to the most recent data, with STEM courses trailing behind. Conversely, only half of those who took AP history tests ended up passing, while calculus and physics saw much higher rates. What gives?
AP, what do you think?
Well, I mean, that makes sense to me. I'm actually not surprised to hear that, right? Fewer people, they're probably the people who are self-selecting into the physics and calculus courses are those who are more likely to go into STEM fields and who've probably done very well in physics and calculus or math and science up until that point, whereas AP is attracting a much broader number of students, and so the numbers are going to be lower. It seems to make sense.
Well, is there like empirical evidence on that? I mean, it seems obvious to me, like in order to take calculus, I mean, you just can't kind of jump there from algebra. You would have had to go through certain gateways to get there. Do we know for a fact empirically that there are more gateways to get into AP physics or calculus than U.S. history? Are schools more willy-nilly about AP U.S. history?
Well, it actually brings up a really interesting point on the math side about AP calculus in particular. And actually, it's a flashpoint in the Common Core math debate right now, because in order to take AP calculus in your senior year, you basically have to have taken algebra 1 in 8th grade.
Mm-hmm.
And so unless you have a state policy, which California did up until very recently, that all students need to take algebra 1 in 8th grade, then the students who are going to self-select are going to be the more accelerated students.
Right.
So yeah, in calculus in particular, you're more likely to have accelerated students taking AP calculus.
Question number 2.
Washington, D.C. has a thriving school choice marketplace, with only a quarter of students attending their assigned neighborhood schools. But according to the Washington Post, some parents are overwhelmed by the multitude of options. And while some parents can afford to pay for advice, others cannot. Does this pose a real problem?
What do you think?
I mean, I think that obviously one of the beliefs behind school choice is that parents will have access to information about the schools so that they can make wise choices. So I mean, I do think if parents don't have access to good information about schools, yeah, I think that's a problem for the marketplace, and I think it is something that we should make sure we're focusing on.
Right. I think in the past, the reflexive response to that from some people has been along the lines of, well, parents can't make the decision, so let's take choices away from them.
Right.
Let's just assign them, and then that has this other set of downsides to it. I actually, there's Georgetown research from the voucher study. It's probably 5, 6, 7 years old now, showing that parents actually become pickier, savvier shoppers for schools when they get more choices. The more options you give them, they start to understand more about the school and its climate and college and career readiness than ever before. So although this is a problem, I think it's a blip. It's I consider it a transaction cost that we have to deal with.
Mm-hmm.
But in the long run, it speaks to something much better, that families have choices and they're going to be hopefully increasingly invested in their schools.
Yeah, absolutely.
Let's hope. Question number 3.
The America's Promise Alliance just released a study where they reported that, for the first time, the U.S. is on track to meet the national grad nation goal of 90% high school graduation rate by the class of 2020. this is good news, right?
Yes and no. It's good news because obviously we've been focusing for many years on increasing graduation rates. It's bad news because I worry that we have been increasing graduation rates by watering down what it means to earn a high school diploma. Even more than that, I wonder whether we're actually, if the Common Core Assessment Consortia live up to their promise and set cut scores where they need to be, and if states align graduation requirements to the standards and to those cut scores, I question whether or not we're going to be on track come 2015 for that goal.
So I think I have to channel Margaret Spellings or Rod Page or maybe President Bush on this one. And this is maybe I'm just out of vogue. Who are the 10% that we don't want or don't expect to become proficient or to graduate? What are their names? Who are they? Let's go talk to their parents and say that we think that your kids are going to be in the 10% that don't graduate.
No, to be clear, I don't necessarily think that that goal is a bad goal. I just don't think we're going to be on track for it. I think that the problem right now is that we've focused on increasing graduation rates at the expense of watering down standards.
I totally agree with you. I mean, you're completely right about that. It's just this 90% goal.
You want the 100% goal.
Yeah, this is where the entire waiver NCLB reauthorization really gets to me. And people are just, I think now, it just has become part of the lexicon. Oh my God, an eye roll with 100% proficiency. We were so silly to assume that was possible. Maybe I'm just like an achievement gap warrior. I just know when you have something below 100%, invariably it's low-income kids and black kids and Hispanic kids who fall into that whatever small category that we think aren't going to be proficient or graduate. And so I just, the hair rises on the back of my neck when we start talking about 90 or 75% or whatever it is.
I don't mind the 90%. What bothers me is how predictable it is by zip code or socioeconomic status. I mean, I wish there was some way to have a more nuanced goal that said 90 or 75% of kids graduate from high school, but that those who didn't graduate from high school weren't necessarily just the poor and minority kids who have maybe been written off. I mean, I think that there are people who may choose other paths and other directions that are totally legitimate. I mean, there are vocational tracks that very successful people can take when they're 16 and 17 years old. And I think there's value to that. I think there's a need for it. And that would impact the 100% graduation rate. But that those examples wouldn't be, they're not the examples that people think of when we talk about dropouts, for example.
Well, so should states have two different high school diplomas? One meaning college and career ready and one for you did what was necessary to get out of high school?
Yeah, I mean, it's a very interesting question that brings up a whole host of challenges, including the tracking challenge, which I think you're getting at as well. I mean, when do students get tracked into college and career readiness if you have those two different paths? I don't have an answer, but it is an important question that I wish we were grappling with more deliberately.
For what it's worth, I am leaning to the side of during the Common Core transition period that states think about this. I'm of the mind mm-hmm. that it's the way that you can maintain a high cut score and get people serious about it without having 50% of your kids not ready to graduate, not get diplomas. We'll see if any state actually adopts that. Well, thank you, Pamela. Thank you, Kathleen. That brings us to the end of Pardon the Gadfly. Now it is time for Amber's Research Minute. Amber, welcome. So great to see you.
Thank you, Andy. Always nice to be here.
So what do you have for us here with the Research Minute?
All right. I'm going to tell you, I get a little bit more than a minute today. It's probably going to be about like 90 seconds. Because we get the new KIPP evaluation, the mathematical one, came out on Wednesday.
Twitter is on fire.
Twitter's on fire. It's called KIPP Middle School's Impact on Achievement and Other Outcomes.
Dun, dun, dun.
A second installation from Mathematica examines the impact of KIPP through two study designs. So let me get the wonky stuff out of the way first. We got a match comparison study of 41 middle schools that compared KIPP students to similar non-KIPP students in surrounding schools. The second part of it was a randomized study of 13 oversubscribed schools that compared KIPP lottery winners to non-winners, which guarantees that both the treatment and the control group are similar in terms of student motivation and parental support, which has been an issue in the past. The results, bottom line, KIPP middle schools had a statistically significant positive impact on student achievement in math, in science, in reading, in social studies. All of the subject areas that were examined. Over a 3 to 4 year span, KIPP students achieve between 8 and 14 months of additional learning growth than they would have otherwise in those subjects. Just one little point, for instance, 3 years after enrollment in KIPP, the estimated impact in math is equivalent to moving a student from the 44th to the 58th percentile of the district distribution, which is about 11 months of additional growth. So pretty impressive. Results from the matched and the lottery designs were similar, with no statistically significant differences between them, which is important in terms of, comparing similar results. Results also show that the impact of having ever enrolled in KIPP, so this is another little wonky point, but folks on the prior evaluation were worried that once the students dropped out, then the impact was artificially inflated because you're only focusing on those who persisted. So they kind of gave it the benefit of the doubt and said even the students who dropped out are still in the treatment group. Mm. And then they also looked at Terra Nova, which is a nationally normed low stakes test, because people were saying, well, the KIPP's teachers are just teaching to the test. They found similar results in the Terra Nova, which sort of suggests that this is more than simply teaching to the state test. Finally, the survey findings, they also surveyed parents and kids. We found that KIPP students complete about 53 more minutes of homework each night. We sort of knew that, but now we've got that quantified. Oddly enough, and this is what some of the reporters are writing about, there was a negative impact on student reports of lying and arguing and losing their temper. And you have to wonder whether the KIPP students are simply more likely to report that than the non-KIPP students, given the culture. So, and then finally, the last bit, they try to isolate where these impacts are coming from, and they say that there's evidence that it's the KIPP's emphasis on student behavior, which we've known about, the longer school day, and that they spend more time on the core academic subjects.
So really, first of all, great, concise summary of a big study.
Big 185 pages worth, I believe. Mm.
Okay, so let's break this down. First of all, two different research designs, mm-hmm. and they went about this so no one could come back and say, well, there's selection bias involved. And so, just to be clear, both research designs led to the same conclusions.
Similar results, that's right.
Which mm-hmm. is, there yep. seems to be, for lack of a better term, a KIPP effect, a highly mm-hmm. positive student achievement in all of the subjects.
That's right, the four that they, the core areas.
Okay, and so how many KIPP schools do you remember participating in this?
It's about 43 middle schools, so just middle schools.
And so I assume that they couldn't get school-level results just because of sampling size, because I ask, because if we look at districts or the charter sector in general, there's going to be a distribution of quality. Some are mm-hmm. going to be high-performing, some middle. In general, this curve would be entirely to the right of the mean, mm-hmm. but did they find super high achievers or super low achievers?
Yeah, when they looked at, especially when they looked at the sub-sample, with the lottery, there were definitely, variances there. Uh-huh. And that's how they end up sort of getting the survey results in terms of how can we begin to parse what's different among the higher and the lower achieving KIPP schools. Uh-huh. So there absolutely are differences. It's not as if every KIPP school is a superstar.
But still, overall, if we consider KIPP a sector, I mean, mm-hmm, it's over 100 schools now, I think.
I think that's right.
In the entire network. Growing to that in, I guess, more than a decade now. Pretty impressive, Kathleen, no?
Yeah, impressive. I have to say, I'm not surprised by the results. I mean, I think that there are a lot of charter schools that get a bad name for doing things like teaching to the test, and certainly there some of that criticism is warranted. But if you were to visit a random sampling of KIPP schools, you are so much more likely to find really thoughtful, engaging instruction that is really pushing kids beyond what the test is asking. And so great news. I'm not entirely surprised. And I think there's a lot that we can learn from KIPP on the instructional side and how they have, obviously they would admit they're not where they want to be, but how they have pushed the envelope further than I think almost anyone at this point.
So I think a lot of our listeners will, their first reaction will be, great, awesome, districts do the KIPP thing.
Yeah.
So mm-hmm. why hasn't that happened?
I mean, KIPP's model is so decentralized, and it is interesting. I mean, one of the challenges for the reform movement as it matures is, I think, moving from finding isolated proof points that this can happen to figuring out how to do this at scale. And frankly, KIPP has not found out how to do this at scale. 100 schools is a lot different than the thousands and thousands of schools that we need to impact. So I think because it's because KIPP has proven that they can do so much more, doesn't necessarily mean that if districts just replicated them, we would see every school in the nation achieving the results that KIPP has. So I think that we need to draw lessons and figure out what it means for systems that look a lot different.
And KIPP themselves admit, you know, our teachers still are working a lot longer hours. Mm-hmm. There's some survey data in this study that show that principals are working, you know, I think it was an average of 6 hours at least a week more than the non-KIPP principals. And they're saying, you know, we hope and it's our goal that as principals stay in these buildings longer and as teachers stick around longer, they can work smarter. We hear that all the time in terms of, you know, not necessarily longer hours. We don't know yet. This is what we have now. So, yeah, I think a lot of non-KIPP schools are saying, well, yeah, if you have people willing to work these really long hours, and we've been hearing this a long time about the burnout of teachers and administrators in these buildings, and I think it's a nut that we've yet to crack, or they've yet to crack in terms of
it's a real impact. Problem. It's very unsustainable.
That's okay, right. So if I want to ask each of you this. If you could talk to one group of people, pick policymakers, philanthropists, you choose the group, what is the one message that you would want to deliver to them based on the findings of this report? How can this have an impact is what I'm getting at.
I mean, I think of it, I think it's a lot of what we've said all along, you know, a lot of these teachers in these KIPP schools are, you know, bleeding hearts, they love kids, they want to work long hours, they're enthusiastic, they're passionate, and in many cases, they've got high verbal scores. We know that's the one thing that's kind of associates with effective teaching. So I think not to go back to it's the teacher quality stupid problem, but I do think that's a key factor in a lot of these schools. These people are willing to work the long hours. They're willing to not accept that kids can't learn. And a lot of it's that sort of squishy stuff that other studies have tried to capture. You know, what is it about these people and these leaders that makes them different?
So, Kathleen, a random billionaire sitting in front of you or the president of the state senate in some legislature, what do you tell them?
That's a great question. So I don't know. I mean, I guess my takeaway from this study and going back to the issue of what can we learn and apply to school systems around the country is I agree with Amber on the teacher quality piece, but I would add to it the data-driven instruction piece. I think one of the areas where KIPP and a lot of like-minded charter schools are really pioneering is in the area of data-driven instruction. And one area where I think some of the best KIPP schools have taken it a step further is really incorporating a lot of the critical thinking skills and analysis that everybody wants to see in schools and figuring out how to drive instruction towards some of those ends. Again, I don't mean to paint an overly rosy picture. KIPP is very upfront about not yet closing the college and career readiness gap, but I think they're much further along than almost anybody I've seen.
And I would say just having teachers feel comfortable with using data, which I guess is something some of these CMOs do. I mean, just this is my, you know, N of five on my Facebook friends account who are teachers. Just one posted yesterday, can we stop bowing down to the god of data, that there's more to teaching than data? And I feel like even some of my friends who are unbiased, who are exceptional teachers in my opinion, are really getting a little bit fatigued that teaching is becoming so much of a science and less of an art. And I don't know how we walk that balance with them, you know, because we know from the Met study and other surveys that teacher morale is low and so on and so forth. So how can we teach them how to use data, but also respect their unique talents and skills that they bring as an individual teacher?
Well, and to understand that data means more than numbers, which I think that a lot of KIPP teachers intimately understand. I mean, I think about I've been able to observe in a couple of different KIPP schools some, you know, teacher team meetings where they're taking data. And I mean, the discussions that they have about where the students are and the interventions they need are amazing. I mean, they are so kid-centered, and they really are looking at, to use a catchphrase, they really are looking at the whole child, and they're really focusing as many of the instructional resources as a team on helping those kids. And so I think they're seeing data more broadly than just numbers, and I think they're really maximizing it in a really thoughtful way. Again, the best among them. This is, I don't mean to imply that everybody's getting it perfect.
So I would agree with everything that you guys said. The one thing that really strikes me is If we were to do some sort of Google search over the last year, maybe 2 years, about the biggest education reform stuff, everyone seems obsessed with blended learning and technology and a bunch of these new shiny objects that I think are exciting and have great potential. But quietly, KIPP continues to do really, really good things. Mm-hmm. And I hope the policy world and the philanthropic world and so forth doesn't just chase the next best shiny thing and focuses on something that's working pretty darn well, because these inputs that we're excited about might not lead to the outputs that we're seeing in this remarkable study. Mm-hmm. So thank you, Amber.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Kathleen. Thank you, Pamela. That brings us to the end. Mike is back next week to do the Gadfly Show. Till then, I'm Andy Smerick.
And I'm Kathleen Porter McGee.
For the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, signing off.
The Education Gadfly Show is a production of the Thomas B. Fordham Institute, located in Washington, D.C. For more information, visit us online at edexcellence.net.